Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. My name is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer here in the area. And each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about science and what's going on in the area. And we bring in experts, and we certainly do have one today. And we also give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. And you're welcome to do that at any time by calling 929-9601. And if you happen to be listening on the Internet, just add the area code to that, 919. And we have a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. And that's all one word. And, of course, your email comments are always welcome as well, at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. Today on Radio In Vivo, we are going to be learning about asthma and other respiratory diseases, and we are indeed fortunate to have as our guest one of the leading experts in the field, Dr. James Donahue. Jim received his MD at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, and we have been fortunate to have him here in the Triangle at UNC since the mid-70s. Jim is a professor of medicine at the UNC Medical School of Medicine and serves as the division chief of pulmonary diseases and critical care medicine at UNC hospitals. He has been an NIH-funded researcher for many, many years, and he has also published prolifically in the research literature. He is also a fellow of the American College of Chest Physicians and a member of the American Thoracic Society and the European Respiratory Society. And on top of his extensive research and professional activities, Jim is also an attending physician at UNC hospitals and has repeatedly been recognized as one of the best doctors in America. And last but not least, having survived many, many video projects together over the course of about 20 years or so, I am proud to count Jim as an old friend at this point. Jim, it's a great pleasure and honor to have you come visit us on Radio In Vivo today.
Thank you, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
And first question is, after that introduction, that sounds like about three people. How in the world do you still find time to see patients with all of your other commitments and responsibilities?
Well, what I try to do is try to keep it all pretty close together. I see clinic patients anywhere from 2 to 3 days a week at UNC. Still do it. Still see a couple of new patients each clinic and 10 follow-ups. I've done that for many years. My research, though, is based in patient care, so it's a lot of phase 3 trials with the actual taking a new medication and actually applying it to real patients and longitudinal studies looking at efficacy and safety. I also, for many years, have had the privilege of attending on the wards in the ICUs of UNC Hospital, which is just a superb institution. It's been an incredible pleasure to work there. But I integrate everything. I do my teaching, my clinical care, and also my clinical research really off of this patient-based activities.
I see.
So I don't have a lab or anything like that, a wet lab.
I see. So you have a group, a cohort ready-made.
That's right. We do into different diseases. We do, and some of them, as mentioned, are NIH-funded. Some are pharmaceutical studies. But the diseases that I have had really a lot of experience in working with have been chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, sarcoidosis, and then a genetic deficiency of alpha-1 antitrypsin, which leads to very severe liver and liver disease and emphysema. So, and we have a clinical center, so patients from throughout North Carolina will come with those conditions, and we'll see them, and we provide sort of subspecialty care for patients with complicated problems like alpha-1, sarcoid, COPD, and asthma. Mm-hmm. So it's been really a very rich and rewarding experience. I've been at UNC since 1973, and it's been a fabulous institution to work for.
Absolutely. Well, I want to kind of structure the program this morning by talking about each one of those diseases in turn and getting your expertise on them.
Great.
Let's start our discussion of the diseases of the lung with asthma, the big one, of course. I know that the prevalence of asthma has been increasing dramatically in recent years. Do you see that in your own practice? And if so, why do you think that's happening?
Well, the asthma prevalence is increasing worldwide, and part of that is because of our success, particularly in the field of pediatrics, in controlling other important pediatric diseases such as infections. For example, in Africa, where there's a widespread tuberculosis, poverty, malnutrition, you're less likely to see asthma in the children. They have much more severe infectious diseases. We're so blessed in the United States and in the West because so many of those diseases have been eradicated. But where we don't have those infectious diseases, we begin to see diseases of the like asthma that are much more common in the Western society. And that's actually called the health hygiene hypothesis. Uh-huh. Our families are smaller, fewer siblings, children are less exposed to bacteria. So they express then what's called a T helper 2 type of phenotype, which is more of an allergic IgE. Quite frankly, I'd rather take my chances with asthma than tuberculosis if I were a parent of a child. But
sure.
But that, I think that's part of the phenomenon. So TB's on the increase, not TB, but both are, but asthma, and particularly in the West here, there are other factors too I think contributes to the epidemic. Our children are very sedentary, obese, they're playing computer games, they're indoors with exposure to indoor pollutants. Mm-hmm. You know, when we were kids many years ago, we played baseball and sports, we're outside all the time running around, and I think a lot of it's just societal changes, and that led to airways diseases like asthma that are increasing.
Sure. Do you see an environmental component?
Oh, very much so. First of all, there's asthma, particularly in children, is a highly atopic condition, so there's high IgE and inherited allergy.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you mean by atopic?
Atopic is just the expression of an allergic type of person,
right?
And as opposed to non-allergic, and well, more than half the people probably have some components of allergy. Indoors, we have more house dust mite exposures. We sealed our buildings in order to preserve heat and air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
So there's higher buildup of house dust mites, cockroaches, and some of the things, indoor pollutants, than previously. And everybody's always concerned about pollen and outdoor things, and they're important in some individuals, but less important than the indoor perennial type of exposures. So I think the environment is extremely key. Indoor cigarette smoking, side stream tobacco is also very important.
Mm-hmm.
For some of our little ones in terms of having asthma.
Sure. Jim, what are some of the most effective treatment regimens for asthma these days? I know that's constantly a moving target. That they pretty much depend on the severity of the disease in the individual. Is that not right?
That's right. And of course, we can get into a very hot topic I'm sure the listeners are concerned about, and that's namely the safety of the medications.
I was getting to that.
But basically, we start out, Ernie, as you point out, there's a way of stratifying or staging asthma from mild intermittent. And that would be a condition which you're really totally without any symptoms or any trouble,
mm-hmm.
Unless you get a cold or some exposure. Then you have symptoms of shortness of breath, cough, wheezing for a period of time. But it's very intermittent. Most patients, though, with asthma have what we call persistent asthma, which means there's constant inflammation down in the lung. And that's stage mild, moderate, or severe. And the medicines are made to meet the stage. For example, mild asthma, mild persistent asthma, could be treated with leukotriene modifiers like Singulair, or low doses of inhaled steroids. Inhaled mm-hmm. corticosteroids are the go-to drugs for asthma. As the condition becomes moderate, then you either have the choices of having higher doses of inhaled steroids, which is unattractive to many Americans and parents. Or you could add a long-acting bronchodilator or a combined classes. And then for the severe persistent, that's a very small number of patients, but they have a really bad disease. They're the ones that have to use the hospital all the time.
Sure.
Here we have to use multiple therapies. A lot of interest, of course, in combinations. And the combination that's in the forefront would be the combination of the inhaled steroid fluticasone and the long-acting beta agonist salmeterol, and that's Advair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
been a highly effective clinical remedy for patients with this condition.
I see. And I do want to get into talking about some of the pharmaceutical agents that are available and their safety, because I know that's a hot topic these days.
It sure is, yeah.
Before we get into that, though, Jim, the latest stats I've seen when I was preparing to speak with you today say that 20 million Americans have asthma currently, and 6 million of those patients are children. Well, what are the special challenges of treating and managing children with asthma?
Well, the first thing comes up in children is just to mention how as a parent, and you know, my three daughters are now grown, how frightening an experience it is for both the little one and the parents, and it's the fear is compounded by lack of education and knowledge of the condition. First of all, with little ones, their airways are little, and it doesn't take much to narrow a very, very small little airway that's in our patients. So you get a viral illness in a child, and that can lead to narrowing. So the little one becomes short of breath, breathes very rapidly, wheezes, and has trouble getting the air in and out. Now, first of all, the first issue with pediatric asthma, is this asthma, or is it just a viral bronchiolitis? You don't want to put a label on a child that has all kinds of social and financial implications.
Sure.
So the pediatricians led by Dr. Fernando Martinez at the University of Arizona and others have come up with ways of dealing with this. And first of all, the diagnosis is more likely if the youngster has repetitive bouts of wheezing or bronchiolitis and their parents are allergic or atopic or have asthma. Then that youngster is more likely not to outgrow it, but to go on to be a clinical asthmatic and will need some preventative or maintenance treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The other issues, though, are little ones are afraid to often bring to attention the fact that they're sick because they don't want a needle, a shot, and what have you, so they'll deny it. Another very important issue, Ernie, has been whether or not the children should be allowed to bring their inhalers to school. Issues with the school nurses. Everyone wants to do the right thing here, but sometimes there are issues of who controls the medicine and what's appropriate. And there's been a lot of, in North Carolina and nationally, a lot of interest trying to get much more flexible programs for the asthmatic child in the schools. And that's been very useful. And then the kids are just too busy to be sick, and there really is a limit on them. And how much, and then you don't want to over-treat them, certainly, because they're young, and you don't want to have an overexposure to inhaled steroids, even though the drugs are very, very safe. So, but you try to titrate to the appropriate medications that best control their condition and keep them healthy and doing everything they want to do. It's essential that the child not sit down and become a couch potato and become obese. And this is the tendency when you're short-winded. You know, you don't want to cause yourself to be more short-winded, so you sit down and become sedentary. And I think that's one of the problems. So asthma camps, things like that can be good. Keep the child active, but controlled. Not active if they're sick, but active if they're controlled.
Sure. So is that really the key for parents who might be listening that have asthmatic children, to keep those kids active and try to prevent those acute episodes from
First of all, get the child controlled. Okay, if this is a very important concept. If your asthma is poorly controlled, it'll manifest itself with shortness of breath when your kid's running around all day. So the first thing is get them on with the pediatrician, the allergist, the family doctor. Get them controlled so that you know they can now tolerate it. But then keep them active. When the child's sick, though, they can't be active. They have to, at that time, get help.
Sure, of course. Well, speaking of the help, you know, I did want to get back into the issue of the steroids and everything, and want to take it kind of at a baseline level, just so people who maybe aren't plugged into this will have an understanding. Many people don't seem to really understand the difference between, you know, the steroids we hear about athletes using and the steroids that are so vitally important in asthma therapy. Would you delineate between the two so folks will understand that we're not talking Barry Bonds here, we're talking about very important medications?
These are very important distinctions, and quite frankly, as you know, a lot of folks are not really cognizant of these differences because it's, you know, steroid sounds like the same thing. And, you know, what Balco was making and what athletes some athletes are reputed to have used. These glucocorticoids used medicinally are inhaled. And through the inhale route, very, very low doses enter the body. For example, if a patient gets sick and has to go to the doctor and get prednisone, they get, you know, 20 milligrams of prednisone or 15 or 5 or even 40. If you come in the hospital and you're very sick, you can get 125 milligrams.
And prednisone is a very strong.
They're very strong, but they're necessary to save your life at times, but the other hand, very powerful side effect profile.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the inhale route are micrograms. Okay, so it's, very, very low doses, and 44 micrograms, 110 would be doses of fluticasone used in asthma. And it's also very important to remember that only 13% of that, or to 19%, get into the lungs. And then from there, most of it is absorbed from the lungs. So what we call the systemic exposure, the exposure of your bones, your eyes, your muscles to those low doses inhaled steroids is very modest and very safe.
Right.
Now, the biggest danger is when you don't use controller inhaled corticosteroids, then you get very sick and have what we call an exacerbation where you have an acute attack, you go to the hospital, and there, lo and behold, you get 40 of prednisone, 30 of prednisone, 20 a taper. That's much more, I think, significant exposure to steroids than taking an inhaler once or twice a day.
Sure. Do you run into people who have that kind of steroid phobia?
It is a factor, particularly in the United States. Folks here are very, some, not many, but some have concerns. Everyone has concerns. They want to use low doses. And remember, an old orthopedics surgeon told me your hip sees every microgram of steroid your body ingests. So there are issues of cumulative exposure. You know, if I'm, 21 years of age and I'm have a chronic disease like asthma and I'll be alive till 78 or 80, that's a lot of exposure theoretically.
Sure.
So people are concerned. One of the other things that one can minimize side effects by being active, first and foremost, that keeps your bones well mineralized, well calcified, a good adequate intake of dietary calcium and vitamin D. And as you get older, where osteoporosis becomes a concern, you have to monitor it. You know, periodically do bone density scans and make sure that everything's all right.
Sure.
It's less of an issue in adults with asthma than in children. And the main concern in children has been a great controversy as to whether or not taking asthma medicine stunt growth, inhaled corticosteroids. And that was a very hot topic for a couple of years.
Right.
And it turns out probably it does not. The first year, asthma itself stunts growth in if it's uncontrolled. And in some people, and I don't want to, worry mothers out there about their asthmatic children. They're probably going to enjoy normal height and whatever they're genetically predisposed. But some children with very bad asthma, frequently hospitalized, do not achieve their program stature. And that might be because of the steroids and the illness itself. There was a lot of controversy about one of the mature steroid inhalers, which was beclomethasone, whether or not it stunted growth. And there is a slight but measurable delay in the first year with that agent. But then the children catch up.
I see.
So I think to put it to rest, the consensus is now that inhaled steroids in the appropriate doses used clinically do not stunt the child's growth and are perfectly safe.
And if anything, perhaps a bigger issue is actually with the use of these inhaled agents, the actual technique to make sure that the patient with asthma is getting enough medication. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely key. One of the problems with the field of airways disease, whether it's asthma, cystic fibrosis, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, is that the medications are inhaled. And there are techniques that have to be learned to deliver the drug appropriately to your lungs. And that can be easier said than done. A lot of people have trouble. One other issue with that, if you have bad lung function because you're very sick, not as much drug gets into your body. It all goes in the lung. But the main thing is to get the technique. So we will, in our clinics, frequently review the patient's technique. And the field's changing. Now we have dry powders now. We have HFA-propelled inhalers. We have the old CFC propellants. It's changing very drastically, and patients are getting very confused by everything.
I can imagine.
Yep.
But the key is to get enough of that drug down into the lung.
And use the right technique. Shake the inhaler, empty your lungs completely. Mm-hmm. As you begin a slow, deep breath, you activate the inhaler, you squeeze down on it, and the cloud comes out. It goes into your lungs, then you hold your breath, and then you exhale out. If you're having a lot of trouble with the older, what are called meter dose inhaler, you could add a spacer, which would be like a 6-inch extender, a little bit of tubing on the end to help you. But those may not work as well with a lot of the newer devices. They don't. You can't use them with dry powders, for example.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. Jim Donahue from UNC, and we are talking about diseases of the lung. Right now we're centering in on the possibly most important one, being asthma. Jim, I wanted to follow up with you as long as we're talking about pharmacotherapy. There has certainly been a lot of controversy, as you mentioned recently, about the long-acting beta agonists, including the addition of black box warnings on some of the drugs that talk about their association with increased risk of asthma-related deaths. And yet those medications, often in combination with corticosteroids, have improved the lives of many, many asthma patients. What is your position on all of this?
Well, my position, and I actually had the privilege of being one of the three doctors to make the presentation at FDA. I think it was July 13th, and there was a pulmonary allergy drug advisory committee which was charged with addressing a number of issues. One was whether or not to leave these agents on the United States market. Two, whether or not what the label should reflect. Mm-hmm. Three was a question: should the black box label be extended to other drugs in the class, such as formoterol or foridil? In an upshot, in my view, the combination in particular has been highly effective. The number of acute asthma events, the number of hospitalizations, the severity of symptoms, the number of wakings at night has been remarkably diminished with the use of particularly the drug in America is Advair, and in Canada and in the rest of the world, another drug, Symbicort, is budesonide and formoterol. So this combination, the combination of an inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist have unique properties. They're complementary. By combining the two classes, you can reduce the total exposure to steroids, inhaled steroids.
Sure.
Their efficacy is second to none. As a doctor, I prescribe these medicines every day of my life. Use them myself as an asthmatic patient, and I think they have an impeccable safety. I say that as not only a physician treating thousands of patients, but as a scientist, I've written extensively on this class of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some new data that, not in asthma and COPD, though, I think that informs us greatly about the safety of this class of drug. Now, what happened, Ernie, historically was, when salmeterol, one of the two combinations in Advair, was initially developed and allowed on the market in the United Kingdom, there was what was called the Cerevent Surveillance Study, published by Castle in the British Medical Journal. And there it was just a large database, and it was compared to albuterol. But there were a few extra deaths in the salmeterol arm over the albuterol arm.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't statistically significant. But I think clinicians would pause and say, gee, what is this? You know, there is a few extra there. So when salmeterol was approved initially by the United States FDA as monotherapy, I might add, this was at an era that people didn't know that you really did need to use inhaled steroids and you should not use monotherapy bronchodilators. And that includes both albuterol alone or salmeterol or formoterol alone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
as part of that approval process, Glaxo was asked to carry on a phase 4 study of the safety of salmeterol, and that's the so-called SMART study, salmeterol monotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Phase 4 being
post-marketing, right, is an agreement between the manufacturer and the, I believe, the FDA. Now, again, I wasn't part of this, but historically, we would never do that study today because we know you can't use salmeterol monotherapy in COPD. But again, back in its time, it was a perfectly legitimate. Anyway, during the course of that study, which was powered on, or the study was looking at whether there were bad events like intubations or deaths, and they were looking at all respiratory. That would include pneumonias and other things. And then, though, in the final analysis, there were 13 deaths, and it seemed to be 13 deaths in the salmeterol arm and 3 in the placebo arm at the end of the day of the SMART study. And the study was stopped then at 23,000 patients enrolled. It was hard to enroll people. The question was no longer a meaningful one.
Sure.
Now, the problem with that is what went wrong. First of all, a lot of those deaths occurred in 1998, 1 year of the study, when the methods of recruiting patients was different than what happened in subsequent years when there were fewer deaths. So that's one unexplainable observation. Secondly, there was the patients were given 6 months of medication and followed by phone. There was no blood drawn. There was no really close analysis of certain things. So whether or not the patients were on inhaled steroids, the only thing we have is one question at baseline: do you take inhaled steroids? So you can't say whether this outcome would have happened had the patients been on inhaled steroids. I believe it would not, very strongly. I have absolutely no qualms at all about putting patients on combinations. But I would not use monotherapy. So that signal is there, a 13 sure. versus 3, very, very rare events. And that's at a time when the asthma deaths in the United States have fallen from 5,200 to 4,200. Mm-hmm. We're doing something right.
In spite of the increasing prevalence.
That's exactly right. And also, I think the numbers of hospitalizations, when Advair is the leading drug in the market, or that combination. So in my view, this is what I tell patients. And, in fact, I was interviewed, I think it was January 3rd last year, on the front page of the News and Observer. We told a story about how someone had heard preliminary warning that stopped their medicine. They asked me what I did. I put them right back on it again. But I have to talk to the patients about it. I say that there is a signal. It's rare. It's more common in our African-American patients. And a big part of my practice at UNC is in the African-American community with many studies that we do. Mm-hmm. We have to have a discussion, inform the patient. But if they ask me what is your view, doctor? I feel they are the best drugs that we have. Mm-hmm. However, we do need to do more studies and try to understand it better. Along those lines, we've just completed a big study. I do not have any data for you, Ernie, in African-Americans on this combination, so we'll have that.
I see.
Last thing I want to say, that to me as a doctor was very reassuring. A big part of what I do is in the older population is COPD research, and we actually did the pivotal studies with salmeterol. This is a population that half the patients have heart disease. Half of them have hypertension and other cofactors. If we were going to see a signal, I think we would have saw it in the COPD, and the data are absolutely clean. There is no signal in this.
Now, when you say signal...
Any events that are occurring. Yes, I'm sorry for saying that.
That's okay.
But that means that there were any observations. So the...
Danger sign.
The danger sign, exactly. That's a better term, Ernie. Okay. Thank you for adding that. There are no danger signs in... at least in this older population, and in my view, if you use the asthma medicines properly, the patients are at no risk with asthma who use these classes of agents. Now, I might add, though, and I have not seen it, there is supposedly a study going to be presented next week by Sally Salpeter, who's one of the leading foes of this class, and we'll have to see what she says and what information she brings to bear. But right now, today is the best knowledge that I have, and I've studied this and written on it. It's the best I can come up with. But I think they're perfectly safe to reassure your listeners.
Very good. Well, Jim, obviously, asthma is an extremely complex disease, and there's a combination of genetic susceptibility and environmental factors. And I know that some of the genes associated with asthma have been identified. But where are we in our understanding of this very complicated disease?
Right. Well, the genes are the genetics of asthma are extremely important, and we're really about ready to see some major discovery. And one of the comments that you just made is very relevant. There are receptors in the cells of our body for which these beta agonists like albuterol, Ventolin, Proventil, Seravent, and what have you, where they attach to the cell. There are some genetic variations, polymorphisms or changes, that might make us more susceptible to the side effect profile. And one is what's called an ARG-ARG substitution on position 16 of the beta receptor. Those individuals who have that mutation, and it's about 12% of the population, so a real number, when they take regular beta agonists, they seem to do less well. That might be one of the reasons for some of these events, like the random deaths that occur on these medications. That's being very intensively studied by the National Institute of Health Asthma Clinical Research Network. Mm-hmm. But that would be an example of the important interaction between environment and inheritance, and that clearly is important.
Sure. Do you think that we will ever get to the day when it will be possible to actually cure people of asthma?
Yes, I do. Maybe not everyone, but I think certain individuals, that's certainly within the realm of a possibility. We might be able to find better disease-modifying properties. The medicines that we have now control the disease, do not change it or make it go away.
Right.
There are some spontaneous remissions, of course, that take place. We need to understand better what causes the spontaneous remission. But no question about it that down the road with certain of the genetic diseases, maybe asthma because it's a complex multi-gene type of disease, it may be a little more problematic. But I look to other therapies that might really have profound impact on the condition so that at least the patient isn't aware that they have it, and maybe the inflammation, the fire goes out in their lungs for a period of time.
Sure.
So I think we're on the threshold of those kinds of discoveries. The pipelines are very, very robust in terms of medications that are coming. Yesterday I had the privilege in Las Vegas, flying out to Las Vegas to give an overview for a new medication that's going to be studied in the United States. And I gave an overview of for 45 minutes of 58 different types of products that are in the pipeline for the development. And some of those, or maybe combinations of those, could have profound effects on a patient's life. The old simplistic idea of just giving the gene itself, like in diseases like cystic fibrosis or alpha-1, mm-hmm. has proven to be overly optimistic and simplistic. It's much more complicated because of the way the body recognizes those genes and what the body does with it. So there's a lot of danger, and the NIH has very, very careful, appropriately so, controls over gene therapy. But I would look for some mm-hmm. other disease modification, some other interventions that'll have a big effect on these. So things, I think the future is, and I really mean this with all my heart, is very rosy. It really is. Things are going to get better in a hurry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there different targets that are being attacked by these new products that are coming out?
Well, there certainly are. There's, first of all, just a simple thing in asthma. Most people who have asthma, and like myself, where it's mild to moderate persistent, it really is a relatively controllable condition with existing therapies. And you can make the existing therapies relatively non-intrusive. You can take a pill like Singular or an inhaled steroid once or twice a day or an inhaled combination once or twice a day.
Sure.
Ernie, though, where the trouble comes is in those with severe persistent asthma, stage 4. They have a lot of neutrophils. They have different, whereas eosinophils, the allergy cells, are the predominant inflammatory cell of a mild asthmatic. They're very different.
Mm-hmm.
They use up that small number of patients, maybe it's 5%, use up 75% of the health expenditures of the folks that have to come in the hospital. A lot of times these are the folks that can die of their condition. So they're different. But just as an example, a drug used in rheumatoid arthritis, Remicade, infliximab, used in Crohn's disease for granulomatous bowel disease, has shown really to be attractive in those very, very severe asthma type of patients. And that's only a pilot study with Interacef,
mm-hmm.
Published in the New England Journal of Medicine as a pilot study. And so that looks attractive.
So are those anti-inflammatories?
Yes, those would be TNF-alpha is tumor necrosis factor alpha is one of the various inflammatory mediators that is very large quantities in asthma. And so that would be an example. Another just in our lifetime was Xolair, which is a monoclonal antibody to IgE.
Mm-hmm.
The first one approved was approved by the FDA a couple of years ago because it reduced exacerbation. So that would be for highly allergic individuals. who have an antibody, IgE, who have failed conventional therapy, who would fall into the more severe. But it's been remarkable. I was a little, I wasn't terribly optimistic when it first came on the market, but we've been impressed that it really has helped a lot of the severe patients. So that's another, and there are many, many other agents, monoclonals against various mediators like IL-4, IL-5, and that are being studied, adhesion sure. molecule, agents that work on adhesion molecules. So there's really a lot going on, and the upside is I think there's just a very, very bright future in this for people who suffer with these conditions.
Well, that's great. You mentioned people with allergies, and it does seem that so many people with asthma also tend to have severe allergies, atopic individuals, mm-hmm. as you defined for us. The two conditions really seem to go hand in hand. What are the implications of that?
They indeed do go hand in hand. We used to use, when I was a young doctor here at Chapel Hill, we used to divide asthma into extrinsic and intrinsic. Extrinsic was the allergic, primarily onset in childhood and teenage years. A lot of rhinitis, allergic rhinitis with it. And then the intrinsic was the 40 and 50-year-old with onset there. They were less allergic, and they had other factors, reflux, left ventricular dysfunction, other things. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to prove allergy testing or anything would be useful in that population, whereas allergy testing and immunotherapy allergy shots are much more useful for the allergic. But getting back, you hit on a very important concept, the one airway concept, that the upper airway passages and the lungs are just absolutely intimately connected. First of all, air goes through your nose and it's humidified, and asthmatics have a problem with warming air and moisturizing air. Okay, so at the EPA, if you wanted to study a provocative substance for asthma, have someone exercise breathing cold, dry air. You could then use a subtherapeutic or subthreshold challenge of some pollutant and do a safe study.
Sure.
So the upper passages not only humidify air, but they warm it, and the upper airway passages filter out a lot of the harmful substances, particulates, and other things in the air itself, in the filters of the nose and what have you. Now, if the nose is dysfunctional, you can have a postnasal drip, and a lot of times that can come down into the lung or at least irritate the upper airway. That's one of the most common causes of patients who come to see me with cough. Secondly, there are important neural connections through the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve, between the back of the throat, the nose, and the lung itself. Mm-hmm. And so you can have those neural connections. One can flat out aspirate nasal secretions not only to the upper airway but down into the lung itself. So they're very, very important. And you can't neglect, as a doctor, if you're treating asthma or you're treating even COPD or cystic fibrosis, you cannot neglect the nose or you're not going to have a successful outcome or have your patient's problems managed. So you have to take care of both together.
Mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
Is there one drug, like a leukotriene modifier, that would be a singular accolade that treats both? And occasionally it does, but that would be in a very mild condition. Usually, though, you have to address both concurrently. That might be nasal steroids, inhaled steroids, or inhaled steroids into your lungs. So there's lots of different options, but you cannot neglect both. They're intimately connected. You know, even a bad disease, let's take cystic fibrosis, or bronchiectasis, a disease where it's increasing in frequency, and people are always asking me, my doctor said I had bronchiectasis, what's that? These conditions, though, are abnormalities of the defenses of the lung, the little cilia hairs that... Well, anyway, if you have an abnormality of the cilia down in the lung, you have it in your sinuses. They go hand in hand together.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
all our cystic fibrosis patients have not only nasal polyps, but problems with recurrent sinusitis.
Sure.
They're highly allergic, and then they have the lower respiratory. And a lot of times when the upper goes, then the lower follows right behind. That's much more serious.
I see. My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jim Donahue, and we are talking about diseases of the lung. And, Jim, you know, you've alluded several times already to one of your areas of interest, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. I understand that condition is also increasing in prevalence and is rising on the list of causes of death in the U.S. What exactly is COPD, you know, perhaps compared to asthma? What's the latest thinking on its treatment and management?
Well, COPD is a very hard term for listeners to understand. And what is it? And people often say, well, they know what emphysema is, and emphysema really carries a harsh connotation. People think that's a fatal illness. But COPD, chronic obstructive lung disease, shares a lot of features with asthma. It makes you short of breath, wheeze, cough, and have sputum. What distinguishes COPD from asthma is that not only is there a reversible, treatable part, but there seems to be some permanent structural damage. Mm-hmm. So much more in COPD. Also, emphysema, which is destruction of the alveolar sacs, and they get real large and don't work very well, is a feature more of COPD than of asthma. Chronic bronchitis, which is a morning cough, lots of smoker's cough, phlegm production, that's more of a feature of COPD than asthma. You know, at 21, if you're allergic and you have sinus problems and runny nose, allergic rhinitis, you have asthma. If you're 65, smoked all your life, you're much more likely to have COPD. In the middle, though, there's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. And I'm one who subscribes to what's called the Dutch hypothesis. I think they're both more related than unrelated. But with the caveat that COPD has more irreversibility to it, and it's a little bit harder to treat.
Sure.
Now, COPD, though, is really a national, a major health problem, whereas asthma is an important problem, and increasing COPD, though, is really going into the stratosphere in terms of its importance. It's going to become the third leading cause of death in America shortly. It is an incredibly important contributing factor. This is all brand new to coronary artery disease.
Huh. You know,
where you have plaques in your heart because of your cholesterol profile and your inheritance, and sometimes inflammatory mediators in the bloodstream make those plaques break down. That's why people are interested in dental plaque, and there were a lot of studies to see if you had good dental hygiene. That could cut down on coronary artery disease. We now know that the inflammation in the lung continues 9-10 years after you stop smoking. This week in the British journal Thorax, I wrote an editorial on another feature of COPD, which is called oxidative stress, because of the inflammation. You have all this oxidative damage, and this continues on also after you stop smoking. So stopping smoking is important. It slows the rate of decline, but really the fires don't go out. They're still burning. So COPD, primarily an adult disease, more geriatric, 60, 65 and up, related to smoking about 79 to 80%. I think it used to be said 15% of smokers get COPD. I think that number is an underestimate. I think it's 27% with some new data.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The important thing, though, is the COPD goes hand-in-hand with heart disease and lung cancer. And the people who smoke and get COPD are at a much higher risk of lung cancer, a much higher risk of heart disease. Again, one of the most important informative studies, you just published a little bit of it, a little tidbit in the Wall Street Journal, but will come out shortly, was called the TORCH study. That was a big study to see if using anti-inflammatory drugs could cut down on not so much lung deaths, but all-cause mortality. And again, that's driven by heart disease. But it mm-hmm, looks like mm-hmm. if you treat, I'm going to step a little bit ahead of the literature here, but I'm going to predict, put my editor's hat on,
okay.
and say that I think, though, that by treating inflammation in the lung, we might be able to have some impact on those individuals that have the two diseases. And remember, more Americans die way more of heart disease than lung disease.
Sure. And that's because of the oxidative stress and the reactive oxygen species being released?
Part of it is. We don't know that exactly. That's part of our theories. But also I think the inflammation is the big thing with the heart, the inflammation in the lung.
Mm-hmm.
When there's an operation that we do for bad emphysema affecting the upper lobe, it's called lung volume reduction surgery. It's done at Duke and to a lesser extent at Carolina.
Sure.
But Duke is one of the major centers in the National Emphysema Therapeutic Trial. When those emphysematous lungs were removed, lo and behold, in the small airways were these little nodules of inflammation. That's the pivotal lesion,
mm-hmm.
and that's what has to be addressed, and that might be what spills over into the bloodstream that aggravates the heart condition.
I see.
And so the idea is, if perhaps if we could suppress that, that maybe we could then cut down on primarily heart disease drives the mortality. That would be real interesting. That's all theoretical, but there's, you know, again, a body of knowledge that's sort of coming together around these common themes.
Sure. Well, it appears that in terms of drug therapy for COPD, more and more the asthma drugs are what are being prescribed. Is that not right?
That's exactly right. First of all, in COPD, the only thing that's ever been shown to really work is smoking cessation. We measure lung function, as we age out, we begin to lose lung capacity. And smokers lose it at an accelerated rate. If you stop smoking, you can cut that loss in half, basically. So there's a tremendous advantage to stopping smoking. The next point, though, is even if you stop smoking, the disease is progressing. And the first thing that we do are medications that, as you pointed out, were used in asthma. Those would include short-acting bronchodilators like albuterol, terbutaline, long-acting bronchodilators like salmeterol and formoterol, the combinations of inhaled steroids. Mm-hmm. But one difference is that there's a great drug in COPD, tiotropium, Spiriva, an anticholinergic, which is much more specific for COPD than it is for asthma. And then in asthma, Singulair and Accolade are very helpful. They're much less helpful in COPD. So there are some little nuances. But in general, the statement that asthma drugs work in COPD is fairly correct.
I see. Moving on, Jim, I know that you're also involved in researching and treating, and you've mentioned two other less common pulmonary diseases, and certainly want to find out more about them, sarcoid and alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. First of all, tell us about sarcoid. What is that?
Well, let's go back again. I was interviewing my picture on the front page of the News and Observer, January 1st, 2005, and I was asked to comment on the tragic death of the great football player Reggie White.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just a man, incredible man in the prime of his life, who completed his career here for Carolina. And the medical examiner put in the newspapers that that he died of sarcoidosis affecting his heart and lungs, and he also, I believe, had sleep apnea. Now, I actually met him once, but I was not his doctor, so I can't tell you anything that the medical examiner did not put in the newspapers. But I was interviewed about the disease because we do so many studies in North Carolina. Sarcoid is as opposed to COPD and asthma, is a condition that affects primarily the alveolar sacs of the lungs. They scar over or are replaced by these little nodules, little round circles of what are called granulomas, collections of cells.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like there should be an organism in there like tuberculosis or a fungus, but there is not.
Hmm.
It's a heightened immune state that is very, very important in two populations. In North Carolina, the African-American community to the east, rural, east of here. But it's also common in Northern Europeans, Caucasians, Irish, Scots, Danes, Germans, and what have you. So it can occur in anybody, but in North Carolina, a little more important in the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And so it basically, 94% of the patients, it affects their lungs and causes damage. Now, the beauty of sarcoid, occasionally it'll go away by itself. It can heal with remission.
Mm-hmm. That's always good.
That's good. The trouble is we don't know who that's going to be.
Sure.
And so if we do treat it, we have to use very difficult medicines. Again, oral corticosteroids, prednisone, Medrol, drugs like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other important organs that it can affect are the eyes and can cause blindness. So everyone who is suspected of this, you have to have a real exam by an eye professional who can do slit lamp and look in the eye.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other organs, frequently the skin, so an unexplained rash, a red, usually raised, that's another part of it. So it's a systemic disease and that affects all the organs of the body.
Is it an autoimmune condition?
Well, no, it's probably an exaggeration of the immune system. So it's different than lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Doesn't have the high sedimentation rate, doesn't have all those markers. It's not too far removed from them in that, you know, both lupus and rheumatoid arthritis can do similar things, but it is a little bit different. Now, the condition, so primarily people should be aware of it if it affects primarily cough and shortness of breath. It can also affect the heart, as in Reggie White, and that's very dangerous. You have to, if you make the diagnosis, which is complex, we implant defibrillators because it can present with sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the good news is that it rarely affects the heart. It almost always affects the lung, the skin, or something like that.
I see.
We have treatment for it, but the treatment's unsatisfactory. Now, what we've done at the University of North Carolina, because we have the most patients in the country at UNC and Eastern East Carolina University and the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, we've done a number of studies. Chris Cox, who's now at Duke University, designed a sarcoid-specific questionnaire to study the effects of this disease on our patients' quality of life. We did a number of studies with new therapies like infliximab. We have Dr. Tilly in our group now is studying sarcoid, looking and finding occasionally evidence of acne bacillus, propionibacter. All diseases have some infectious component, so we're looking at that. Mm-hmm. But what I do want to mention, what was in the News and Observer article, we just completed a very large genetic study. A study was done in African-American families, and we looked at affected sibling pairs. And then we also got blood from unaffected sibling pairs.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, the support that I got from the community is just magnificent. Worked through the African-American churches, and we had already established a great record of support group, of helping the patients, and we have people who would come to our support groups, and we had a great relation to begin with. But the churches just got out there, and you know, people often, there's a lot of, based on the Tuskegee experiments, a lot of reluctance in the African-American community to participate in research because of bad previous misadventures and bad outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the case in our study. This was funded by the National Institute of Health. We were supposed to get 38 patients, and we got 58. That was just to show you the overwhelming support that I received. And folks in the community here in Chapel Hill and in the churches really helped us. Anyway, from that, though, you're able to, by looking at the gene pairs, sibling pairs, is really a very good technique to find what the genetic areas of interest are.
Right.
And then you compare it to unaffected siblings, and we had parents and what have you. And that data is really still being plowed. But suffice to say, right now, the area of interest is on chromosome 5, and then they have to do fine mapping. Again, I'm only a clinician. I got the patients, right. And I had the relationship. So
I'll put you in touch with the mouse genetics guy I had in last week.
That's right. The genetics folks are the experts. They're doing all the studies.
Yeah.
And but from that, we've learned an incredible amount already. And the hope is that we can really focus in on where the genetic abnormalities, so that very specific therapies that target this condition can be reached. Right now, what happens is as follows. You know, a young black woman will come in with sarcoid. Perhaps 50% of her lung function has been injured. I don't know if it's going to come back spontaneously or not, but she's sick, so I got to treat her.
Sure.
Well, I treat her with prednisone, 40 milligrams, 30 milligrams. You know, within 2 months, she weighs, 100 pounds more. Her husband doesn't love her anymore, maybe, or whatever. She feels that.
Sure.
And then she has more fatigue, more chest pain. I haven't helped her. I've made her worse.
Yeah.
And this is the state-of-the-art therapy. We found that out from the question, because we developed, Chris did, instruments.
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm.
surprisingly to me, I thought, the lung function went up from 40% to 80%. Hallelujah, I'm feeling really good about myself.
Right.
And I have this depressed patient
quality
there.
Of life has plummeted.
That's absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we really have to do better than this. I mean, using prednisone is like amputating your toe with a sledgehammer or something like that, or an axe. It's not specific, not targeted at all. So we're very disappointed in the treatment, but we're really beginning to turn the corner. Finally, the National Institute of Health put some money in the condition. There's a lot of interest in the state. We're hoping to get to talking to members of the legislature to get more additional help. So, but that this is an important health consideration to many members of our community in North Carolina.
I see. Now that sounds like it's basically a genetic condition, and in the just few minutes we have left together this morning, Jim, I do want to give you a little bit of a pulpit to talk about alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. I know that's one of your interests, and I know it's fairly rare, but it's a often very devastating disorder with pretty significant morbidity and mortality. Could you share with our listeners a little bit about this disease and its typical outcomes and treatments?
This is a disease caused by what is called the ZZ genotype. And basically what happens is that people who have this condition either have experienced very, very severe liver disease as children, ascending cholangitis, may even die of it, Or if they go into adulthood, they get terrible emphysema at an early age with very modest exposure to smoking. Mm-hmm. The tragedy is that it almost every patient, they have to see the doctor multiple times. On average, it takes 3 to 5 years. And it's treatable. We have replacement therapy today. So anyone who has early onset of COPD, bad asthma, intractable asthma, or liver disease should be screened. It's a simple blood test. Sure. I know that there's all kinds of issues with having genetic diagnosis and stigmata applied, but we'll test you anonymously. I can do that, and my nursing staff will just send your blood to the University of Florida if there's any consideration.
Sure.
But basically, we have replacement therapy for it, and it's once you start the replacement therapy, at least as far as the lung disease goes, it's highly curable, highly treatable, not curable, treatable. This would be a condition, though, that genetic therapy, I hope someday, will cure. It's a reasonable target.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's emphysema, early onset, strong family history of having lung and liver disease. These are the things to screen for. UNC is a Alpha 1 center. Some of our patients are the leaders in the field, and not only on the national, but have published extensively. And so if you have it, it's... It involves getting an intravenous infusion of the replacement alpha-1 antitrypsin in your blood every 1 to 2 weeks.
So that's an enzyme in the lung, is
yes,
that correct?
Yes, it is. It's manufactured in the liver, and your ZZ, it doesn't get out of the liver. It sticks in the liver.
I see.
And over the years, it can accumulate, causing damage to the liver, even cirrhosis and even hepatoma.
Mm-hmm.
But in the lung, you don't have enough of it around. So if you smoke a cigarette, all the inflammatory cells just eat the lung alive. There's nothing to protect you, so you get large... emphysematous blebs. But the thing about it, if it runs in your family, lung disease, or if you have liver disease that runs in the family, get screened, because it's really, we can treat you for that, and
sure.
There's no excuse
okay.
for that, letting that go by. And I'm very animated about that topic. That's one we can really help if we get it, if we diagnose it early. And UNC is a center of excellence for that in South Carolina. Medical University of South Carolina is another one.
I see.
Two in the area.
Well, Jim, we are just about out of time this morning, but I want to get your 30-second answer on the big picture with diseases of the lung. Are you optimistic that we're really turning the corner on some of these things?
I really am. I have to give a plug. This is the 100th anniversary of the American Lung Association of North Carolina. We just kicked off our centennial. And last Tuesday night at the North Carolina Museum of History, I was given a chance to quote, make a couple of comments. This state has an incredible tradition of fighting in the fight against lung disease, despite being a tobacco legacy state. We are really on the threshold, though, of understanding the diseases because of the science, much of it in North Carolina, the prevention and disease modification, the things patients can do themselves, and then lastly, the treatment. So good things are ahead, and it's a terrible thing to be short of breath. It's a terrible thing to lose your life to lung disease. And we're really optimistic. I wish I was starting my career today rather than ending it. It would be. We're really going to be able to help people, and I'm very pleased about that.
Well, I know you have a lot of career left ahead of you to see some of these good things. And, again, we're really fortunate to have you right here in the Triangle. My guest today has been Dr. Jim Donahue from UNC. And we have learned all about lung diseases and optimistic outlook for the future. And, Jim, I want to thank you again for coming
Good
and joining
to see you
me.
Again.
Folks, I actually have a big assignment in my life due next week, so we're going to rebroadcast one of our recent Radio in Vivo programs. And we hope you will tune in for that. And the following week, we're going to have some folks in from the EPA to talk about some very interesting things that they're up to. My name's Ernie Hood, and I want to thank you for listening to Radio in Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on volunteer-powered WCOM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill.